lot's gone on in the past year. I don't know if you noticed, but people started caring about sexual harassment all of a sudden. I want you guys to know, I get it. Of course you want to touch women. They're impossible to resist. I relate to your frustration because sometimes I will see a service dog at the airport. Because I'm going to pet that fucking dog. I mean, it's a dog. It obviously wants it with that adorable little butt. I can see its butthole. If that's not asking for it, I don't know what is.
Hello, and welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. My guest on this week's show is the very funny Whitney Cummings. Whitney is an incredible stand-up comic. She's a writer, she's a showrunner, and it was so fun to talk to her about all of her work. Her new special is called Can I Touch It? It's streaming on Netflix starting today, so definitely check that out if you haven't already. We talked about all of that, plus how she got her start in comedy, creating the shows Two Broke Girls and Whitney, and also what it was like to work on the Roseanne reboot before that went down in flames. As always, I would like to remind you to please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know who your favorite guest has been so far, who else you'd like to see on the show. Are there any questions that you really want me to ask guests? It really helps people find the show, and I really appreciate if you could do that. So, without further ado, let's go to my conversation with the very funny Whitney Cummings. So, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me. I'm a fan.
Oh, you are?
I listen to the show.
Oh,
yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Good to hear.
It's weird to see you in person.
Yeah.
I know your voice well.
Yeah, it's been fun doing the show. Are we good to go?
Who's been the least? Well, no, you can't tell me that.
I'll tell you. What do you want to know?
It's just I'm going to say who was the least funny guest you've had. You can't say that.
Well, it's funny. I think this show is interesting. I kind of set out to do a show that wasn't like laugh a minute. Like,
oh, then I'm your guy.
Like comedians, but sometimes we talk about like real shit.
And, yeah.
But a lot of comedy podcasts are like very funny, and I want the show to be funny, but I don't want
book me? I'm not funny on podcasts. It's a weakness.
That's okay.
I have.
I think a lot of comics on podcasts don't want to. They spend a lot of time trying to be funny. So on a podcast,
feels desperate.
Yeah.
When I do it, at least I am not funny during the day.
Yeah.
It's a general rule. Yeah. Like 7:30. That's when the yuck yucks really kick in.
Have you had to shoot stuff during the day, and is that problematic?
Like acting, I can do it, but like stand up, there's something about the lights that just, there's nothing funny about this lighting.
Yeah.
I think for us, I don't know if it's just a Pavlovian thing, but just like, you know, the sun goes down, 7:30, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just like a training
Makes sense.
Pavlovian reaction. I don't know.
Well, I got to see your new special, Can
oh,
I Touch It?
Wow.
I really, really enjoyed it.
Did?
Yeah, it was great. And it's your first one on Netflix, right?
It's my first special. I have a special on Netflix. It's an old special that I did for Comedy Central that they bought, but everyone thinks it's my new one, but it's 10 years ago, and I'm just yelling. I'm like, men and women are different!
Yeah.
And everyone's like, love your new special. I'm like, oh, God, please don't think that's what I would do now.
Yeah, I mean, the Netflix phenomenon is pretty crazy just because that's
Wild.
Where people are finding stuff. I mean, is that what made you want to go with them? Because it's become so central to the stand-up world?
Yeah, I mean, I hope this doesn't come off gross. I know when women are ambitious, sometimes it's yucky, but you know, the idea is for as many people as possible, you know, to connect with and make as many people as possible laugh. And they have such a big platform. You know, as a comic, I think, you know, when I first started, the dream was like an HBO special. Mm-hmm. Like that was it. That was like, you know, and so I always had that dream. And I remember it was between HBO and Netflix at the time. And my last one, I was like, you know, let me just do an HBO. So this is just, you know.
But that was, Netflix wasn't even a few years ago what it is right now.
Exactly. But it still would have been great. Yeah. I just kind of was like that HBO special thing was just, you know, it's like you do Carson. That was a big deal for the generation before me. Or you do Leno or The Tonight Show. And then for me, it was like HBO special. So
yeah, now I suspect that an HBO special is getting far less people watching than Netflix, even though we don't really know because Netflix won't tell anyone. But it seems that way just from the conversation and talking to people about it.
And I think it's also like a different type of viewer as well, different, you know, demographics from what I understand. I mean, HBO, you have to put in like a couple passwords to get to, you know, someone.
Yep.
I always say like the quality of an HBO viewer might be like a super fan because they have to.
They have to work a little harder.
Exactly, totally. They have like so many options to do a U-turn when they're searching for you. But, you know, HBO is, I'm just such a fan of the quality of content they do.
Yeah.
So I was proud to do that. But now Netflix makes a lot of my favorite shows, you know, so it's cool to be on there. And it's also worldwide, you know, so I think that in Comedy Central, I don't know what countries they're all in, but HBO, I mean, sorry, Netflix is just like...
Yeah.
Crazy.
So, so you're we're about a week, a little less than a week away from it. When we're talking now, this will be released on the day it's out, so people can check it out right now.
It's now streaming?
Now streaming.
It's so funny. The funny thing they said to me when I went in for the marketing meeting, and by the way, I just got really like uncomfortable talking about it because I just I'm embarrassed promoting stuff, but I went to this big marketing meeting, and you know, they make different poster. They make tons of different posters, and it, depending on what algorithm you're in, you might get a different poster and what you're watching.
Right.
And the head of comedy was like, just so you know, the day your special comes out, it might not be on your Netflix, on the home
just
screen.
As a warning, because you might not be the target audience for your own special.
For myself, So it's like, because he said a lot of comedians would call in and say, like, well, how come my special's not on my homepage? Which just reveals that you're an asshole that doesn't watch other stand-up specials.
Oh, yeah. Do you watch other stand-up specials?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
So hopefully you get to see it.
Yeah, I mean, I think based on my algorithm, and you've seen it, I like, I watch things about robots, and I watch comedy, so I hope, mine would
cross-section there.
Yeah, I've just watched Ex Machina again.
Oh,
so.
Yeah. Do you have a kind of fascination with robots?
Because I'm obsessed, yeah.
Because, so, for anyone who doesn't know, the special... The towards the end of the special.
Spoiler alert!
Well, is it a spoiler? I mean, it's in the little, it's in the poster. And
But I don't think people in the poster will know
what's
going to happen.
Do you want to not spoil it, or do you want to talk about it?
I think we should spoil it.
So there's a robot of yourself that appears towards the end of the special that you unveil.
How did you feel when you saw it?
It's definitely creepy. I feel like I was probably not as creeped out as you were when you saw it, which we also get to see a little behind the scenes.
You know what's weird? I am not that creeped out by it. Maybe because I was paid for a lot of it and I'm invested in it being cool.
Yeah.
But there's an interesting, and I'm not like a, you know, trying to do like there's a difference between men and women neurologically, calm down comment section. But there's something called pathogen avoidance where humans have evolved to be, you know, a little bit repelled by something that looks human but doesn't act human. It's our body's way of avoiding trying to procreate with something that's sick or diseased.
Oh, wow.
But I do notice that guys in general are a little more creeped out by
That's interesting.
Like, girls are like fascinated by it. Guys are like, ugh!
Yeah.
I hate it. My fiance hates it.
Really? Yeah. So, I mean, when it's not talking, it's less creepy than once it's
but
the
then
talking
his eyes are moving
are
around.
Weird. Yeah.
The talking to you is the creepiest part?
Well, the way it talks, I found a little creepy because it's like, it's not really, they haven't quite got the like mouth movement part of it down
at
for
all.
The talking.
It looks like bad German subtitling or something.
Yeah. But yeah, so you in the special you also talk about your fiance got to spend some time with the robot when you went on vacation. Is
he
that
hates
that's
it.
True?
In his words, one of you is more than enough. but yeah, he because when you see it, there is something just wild. I mean, with the Uncanny Valley or whatever it is. But he says like, and I tried to put a Ring camera in to spy on what happens between him and the robot when I'm out of town. But I'm trying to get Ring camera footage because every time he walks in a room and sees it, he's like, oh, fuck. Like, it's just like he gets so angry that it scares him every time. But yeah, it's a sex, basically a sex doll body. You know, they don't have human robot bodies. I mean, Boston Dynamics has, but my head shouldn't be on a giant Terminator body. But the face is a robot. And it is wild, like... They're still working on the muscles around the nose and the mouth so that the talking matches up, but it is a little janky.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to, how did you decide that was something that you wanted to do and include in the special? Or was it always?
I'm mentally ill. Yeah. I mean, what do you, like, what's your reaction? I'm just so curious.
Yeah.
Like, did you think it was crazy? Did you think it was fascinating?
Well, I thought it was a very original idea for, you know, especially for a comedy special to kind of bring out another version of yourself to interact with. I'd never seen anyone do that before. So that
well, you know, I was talking so much about sex robots. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I ended up cutting it down to like 25 minutes, but I had about 45 minutes of material on sex
just
robots.
Just when you were doing your act out and about. And,
And I'm just fascinated by the next thing that nobody's, like last special I talked about, like egg freezing, like stuff that's like, this is on the horizon. Why isn't anyone talking about it? Is it shrouded in shame or puritanical ideal? Why aren't we talking about the fact that sex robots are being made and in the next 20 years, they're going to be like iPhones, like everyone's going to have one. And, you know, none of us are really talking about it. So I just got fascinated by it. And I think that just during this, you know, this moment of Me Too and you know, there's lots of real problems that have been brought to the surface and illuminated with women in the workplace and whatnot. And I'm reading all these articles where people think like sex robots are going to ruin society. It's like, no, no. On the list of things that are going to ruin society, that's like doesn't break the top 1,000. And so I just started reading about this backlash and how bad it is for women and how bad it is for women. And I just did not agree with a lot of the fears people have about it. I mean, it's just proven. I mean, porn is you know, there is proof of how damaging too much porn can be on the human brain, and that's available and ubiquitous, and no one, you know. So I just thought it was interesting that people were so angry about the idea of sex robots. So I went down to the factory to see what was going on, just to make sure that I wasn't advocating, you know, something that is destructive or for like pedophiles or some crazy shit like that. And then when I went to the factory, I started, you know, you saw in the special, I don't want to be a broken record or bore you since you've already heard it, but I started learning all these things at the sex robot factory that was actually really that were encouraging to me and weirdly healing. And then he was like, do you want to have one made one of you? Like, they were going to do one of Robert Downey Jr. for some show. And he could, like, the technology's just available to do it. And they were like, we just want to try it with someone. Can you do it? And I was like, fucking yeah. What am I going to say? No? Like, what kind of weirdo would say no?
Yeah, so it was actually there. They broached it first before kind he said, of, can I have one of me?
I know. Or? And I was like, am I a narcissist? You brought it up. I'm not a narcissist. And then I think I was kind of at the point where I was like, there's just so much content out there right now. There's so many good TV shows. There's so many good specials. There's so many people on Instagram doing such funny shit. People that I don't think Hollywood would really be giving a chance or would never have the shot to make things the, you know, traditional way. And there's just so much to compete with. And I think I was kind of like, if I'm going to talk about sex robots for 25 minutes, one better fucking come out at the end.
Yeah.
You know, just to earn, you know, the amount of time that people are spending on watching a special.
And we get to see a little bit of, in the special at the end, you trying it out on audiences before you tape the special.
Did you like
and
that?
And some of the technical difficulties that you had.
Yes.
So what were the audience reactions like when you started bringing it out?
It was so wild that, you know, I think as a comedian, you start to get desensitized over time. I don't know if anyone's talked about this on your show, but like, you know, a laugh is like nothing anymore. It's like, it's like, you know, it does not get it up for me at all. It feels like I'm bombing when I just get laughs. Like applause breaks, I'm kind of like, ah. And then you get suspicious. You're like, well, you're just clapping because you paid money to come see me. And
yeah, you want to like it.
You want to like it. And you're just here, you know, whatever. You start to just get so cynical. And I think for me, like, you know, my standard for the kind of reaction that I wanted, you know, and the kind of performance I wanted to give and the kind of feeling I wanted people to leave with, you know, it just started getting higher and higher. And I was like, laughs, I can do. Applause breaks, I can do. I know how to make people laugh. I'm really proud that I can do that. But like, how can I really make people leave this experience and be like, keep talking about it and make it just really memorable? You know, I take it very seriously that people come, pay money, they get a babysitter, they pay for part. It's $200 to go see a comedian.
Yeah.
You know, that's I take it seriously. So I was like, what's the thing I can do to like shock people? And nothing shocking anymore. You know, it's I was listening to a podcast with the guy that runs Veep, and he was saying that like they can't, like they had to go the other way on jokes because all the edgy jokes they had started happening. Like they had a pee tape joke and they had to cut it. Like
they can't top reality.
Totally. Kind of, that's what's happening. So for me, I'm like, we have to look for new ways to shock, new ways to be surprising. Like
beyond reality.
Sex isn't edgy anymore. Saying fuck isn't edgy anymore. You know, this sort of PC thing has started to make some benign things really offensive out of nowhere. Yeah. But to me, I was just like, what can I do in this special that I haven't done before? I don't want to just do another 50 minutes of jokes, you know, or just 50 minutes of material. And Jordan Peele, I'm a big fan of. And I thought it was really interesting that he's sort of in this genre of like, holy shit. You're laughing, but you're like,
it's a different kind of laugh.
Totally. It's wild. And I think I really was interested in that you can be funny, but also kind of maybe scary and shocking. And when I was in La Jolla, which is what you saw, that tape that's at the end, that was, I only got to rehearse with her 4 times.
Oh, wow.
And so things were going wrong and shit, but we have the video of the audience member and people were like pumping their hands in the air. They were getting up and walking in circles. People, it was just wild. You know, I mean, a robot's kind of a Rorschach test in a way. Everyone has a different reaction, projects their own shit onto it. And people are like, oh, fuck. They were covering their eyes and like, you know, It was interesting. We had, of all the reaction shots we had of the audience, in every one, there was at least one person who put their hands up in the air and started punching the air. It was just, you know.
Just because they were so excited?
Yeah, they were just like, didn't know what to think. Yeah. It was just so surprising. And she does weirdly, like, I guess, look like me.
She does.
We worked really hard to make, I mean, I've aged her by 10 years in the last 6 months, but... But there's just something so creepy and inexplicable and funny and just fucking weird and insane. And I think we're at the place where if you're going to make something, it better be holy shit.
Yeah.
Good.
So you also mentioned that the Me Too movement kind of was in your head while you were putting together this material.
Yeah.
How did that play into, how did you decide, you know, that you really wanted to get into to that stuff as well?
You know, it's such a, you know, flammable topic. And I think as a comic, like, and writer, whatever I do for a living, it's always just trying to figure out, like, what's a joke? What's a movie idea? What's a TV idea? What's a tweet? Mm-hmm. What's an Instagram story? Like, what goes where? And how much real estate does a concept or joke need? And I think for me, you know, with what happened to Me Too, like, Twitter did not feel like a smart way to express myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, stand-up, I think, was the only way to really give it the real estate that it deserved and the nuance that it deserved. So mm-hmm. I actually waited until my special, which is coming out, is out now, to really weigh in on it. Because when I would weigh in on it on social media, it was just, like, just too much.
Yeah, the instant responses or the...
Yeah, and just kind of, like, you're doing... You stop. No one wants to hear about this, and you're not doing enough. You're doing too much. You know, it was wild. Like, I posted something about Time's Up, and I lost like 5,000 followers.
Oh,
people were like, "Feminazi bitch!" Like, wait a second. You know, so I think that for me, I was like, this is a topic that is so complicated that I would rather just present it in a way.
And really, like, think about it and decide what you want to say.
And I don't want to be the person who's just like trying to get likes off of tweeting about something that's in the zeitgeist and relevant, because that feels gross and dirty, and then you kind of become the voice of the, you know, I didn't want to become the face of something that I, you know, wasn't, I just didn't want to inject myself into a conversation without earning it with ideas.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, over these last couple of years, a lot of women in Hollywood are kind of talking about how this movement has made them rethink some of their experiences that they had earlier on. Did that happen to you? Do you think about things in a different way now than you used to?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think for me, the most valuable thing in that, you know, experience of touring with that material, and it kept changing because I had 30 minutes on, you know, creepy directors and, you know, Me Too and harassment in the workplace and all this stuff. And then I went on tour to places that were not New York and L.A.
Yeah.
And San Francisco and Chicago. And I had women heckling me hilariously. I remember one time I was talking about a specific case that was in the news, and this woman just yelled, "Take the compliment and move on."
Wow.
And then women would come up to me after shows, because I like to talk to people after shows, and they were like, what is this? Is this a bunch of rich white women complaining about getting their asses grabbed in the peninsula? Like, we don't give a shit, you know? And I had not experienced that point of view. I had a lot of waitresses who were telling me, "We flirt for tips."
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is, sex is like, the only power we have.
We don't want this taken away from
us. Exactly.
In a way.
Vegas showgirls, when I'm in Vegas, they're like, if Me Too hits Vegas, we're out of a job. This is sex and objectifying ourselves is how we make money. So for me, I don't have to, you know, necessarily agree or relate, because I can't. But that was something that I really wanted to incorporate into this. It's not like one didactic, myopic point of view.
Yeah.
And, you know, because there are a lot of people that kind of are starting to roll their eyes at this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was important. I ended up trashing like 20 minutes of the material I had and rewriting to kind of honor how this has evolved and the backlash and try to address that. You know, there was a bit in it that you saw where it was like talking about how people are going, well, all these women are lying. Some women are lying, and what that is like. Because that to me is now sort of more what the conversation
is. Yeah, the backlash to it.
Yeah, and how we navigate that. And I think that it being men versus women has been a very big mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as someone who talking about men versus women is sort of for a long time been what I specialize in. So I know that it's ironic that I'm the person saying that should stop. I hope I was fair. Do you think I was fair?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting that you wanted to acknowledge some of the stuff you were hearing on the road, because it is so different than what, you know, I think we hear in Hollywood and New York and all these places.
Yeah, and I mean, and I think that it was just, you know, and for me, like, yes, have I dealt with sexual harassment in Hollywood? Of course I have. Mm-hmm. Was I conscious enough at the time to even understand it was happening? Like, no. But, you know, I've also been treated really poorly by women in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not a comedy. You know, so I think my comedy brain is always like, okay, what's the stone we're not turning right now? And what's the flip of that? Even if it's just like a thought exercise. And I was feeling, and I talk about in special, and I'm sure I'm going to get shit for it, when I'm sort of rhetorically asking, does anyone have any friends that think they're feminists, but they're actually just assholes? You know, because there is this thing now where you're not allowed to say anything negative about a woman ever.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so I'm not allowed to judge Ann Coulter because she's a white, like, you know, it just feels a little bit like, you know, a lot of my girlfriends are feeling like, okay, but what we're feeling, you know, and I'm a comedian, so I feel it. Now I'm feeling like there's things I can't say. Now I'm feeling like bullied to say the right thing and support specific people and follow certain people and post certain things. And, you know, and I think that, you know, I kind of just wanted to explore both sides.
Yeah. I mean, on the flip side of people coming up to you and saying, have you, you know, that they disagree with maybe some of the stuff you were saying about Me Too, you know, women telling you that. Have you had the other experience of people getting offended by something that you said?
Oh my God. Yeah. But I think for me, it's like, you know, Me Too is, you know, marching and I'm doing, and it's obviously it's pivotal. I mean, it's the most important thing to happen in my lifetime, you know, and I'm a survivor, but I didn't come forward with my stories because I don't want to be defined by that. And, you know, I'm not comfortable yet, you know? So I think I felt this pressure to like come forward before I was ready and, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, yeah, I'm going to be honest. I cut a lot of stuff out of this special because I was afraid of backlash.
In what sense?
I did a bit about, you know, like it was about girls that think they're feminists and they're actually just assholes. And, you know, it was in the section about like, now that people care about what we have to say, we got to pull it together. The Rosé All Day shirts have to go. And I had this whole litany of things we had to get together, like improve.
Stop doing.
Yes. And I had a no more Native American costumes at Coachella run, and it was Native American, and then someone says don't say Indian. I was saying Native American Indian, but the Native American, and then someone was like, no, it's Indigenous people. And out of just more out of respect, I just didn't want to get it wrong. I'm not like, oh, I can't say anything anymore. I'm not one of those people. I just truly didn't want it to get it wrong, and I was getting so much different feedback that I didn't want to make a mistake. And then I, by accident, like in some crowd work, said something that was like, ah, oh, nope, can't say that. Like, I end up cutting a lot of stuff. And you guys might not notice it, but I notice
the cuts,
continuity issues of things that I cut because the joke wasn't worth the backlash from people.
Yeah.
I had someone come at me on Instagram because the poster is a robot, my head on a robot with the, arm sort of the skin peeled back and you see the
so you can tell
machine
it's a robot.
Of the arm and someone was like, are you making fun of disabled people? And I was like, oh my God,
yeah.
I cannot believe that could have been construed that way. So, you know, I think that the last thing I want is like negative feedback.
Yeah.
I am a comic after all.
Yeah. So, you know, you said you haven't been comfortable talking about your own experiences in that.
I mean,
world.
I talked about the director. I talked about a story about like, you know, a lot of people were complaining like, well, how do these women even remember what happened? It's like a lot of times when you deal with assault, you either block it out or, you know, you repress it. Like there are things that happened to me in my 20s that I'm like, oh, that's what that was.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, I just thought that you have auditions in directors' bedrooms. Like, I just didn't know that wasn't a thing. I used to be like, oh, I thought you just like go to dinner with agents and have to make out with them to get represented. Like, I just, you don't know what you don't know.
Coming up, Whitney talks about how she handled sudden success at the age of 28 when two sitcoms she created got picked up at the exact same time. So I want to go back a little bit and talk about sort of where you came from. You grew up in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I did.
What was your childhood like, and what how did
it was
comedy
great. How did you tell?
How did comedy kind of play into your early years?
I was not a funny kid. I had I grew up in an alcoholic home, which is, you know, a very and of the youngest, so already, you know, fighting, I think, just in terms of how I became a comedian, I think fighting for attention, trying to sort of keep levity. You know, my family was very passive aggressive in a way that I now know is kind of like jokes, you know, it was just sort of jab, jab, jab. That's how we communicated and showed love to each other. And I think for the most part, I was alone a lot. I had to entertain myself a lot and I had to kind of try to cheer people up a lot.
Yeah.
I had a lot of borderline personality disorder in my purview, and that's a lot of, I never know when someone's going to be in a good mood or a bad mood. And so I got to be ready to make them laugh and cheer them up at any moment. And I now am able to look back and go, oh, that was probably like the seed of becoming a comedian. And no, but I was really serious. I thought I was going to just do dramatic acting my whole, I thought I was going to be a journalist first.
Oh, really?
And I was awful at it. Yeah. I interned at a local news station, NBC in DC. I remember Barbara Harrison was the anchor and she was so good. And they let me get up and like read off the prompter to have like a reel. It's back when you needed like a VHS tape. Like I was going to get an anchor job when I was 19. I don't know what I was doing. And I went to J. Crew and I got a shirt and I did the whole thing. And they had the teleprompter coming up. And it was about a kid that had been kidnapped and they couldn't find him. You know, local news is not is always sensational.
It's a lot of that.
It's a lot of that, which obviously I guess that should be on, but just horrific and a bummer. And there's lead in your water and, you know, are there killer bunnies? I mean, it's always just brutal. And I started reading about this horrific thing and I just started making jokes about it because I couldn't handle how rough it was. And I just realized, oh, you know, this is how I cope.
Yeah. And this isn't going to work.
No, at all. So I was like making fun of the kid. I was like roasting the kid that had been, was missing. It's like, who would want to kidnap him? Anyway, like I was just like, okay, being serious is not my strong suit and being unbiased is not my strong suit. You know, you know, journalists now I think can have really strong opinions, but back then it was all about like.
Especially that kind of like local news. You're not, you're sticking to
neutral,
the script.
Totally. And you're being neutral. And so, so that didn't really work. And then I went to college for journalism at Penn at Annenberg, but it was interesting because I didn't know at the time, but it was, I think, preparing me for comedy because a lot of what that program was about was like advertising and subliminal messages in advertising and deconstructing like nature versus nurture and causation versus, you know, like in terms of like, does video games cause violence? Like stuff like that, which I think are the way that comedians like to think.
That's interesting.
You know?
So that actually prepared you for comedy in some way.
I was just so fascinated by it because I love thinking about like the effects of detrimental effects of something, which kind of is what comedy is about.
And then when did you end up trying stand-up for the first time?
I guess I had moved out here and I did that show Punked on MTV. And a couple comics had done it before, like BJ Novak had done it, you know, Dax Shepard had done it. And so I got that job and I was like, okay, a lot of comedians are doing the show. Even though I got the job because I played everything super straight and wasn't trying to be funny.
You're sort of one of the people who are tricking the
but
guest.
You can't try to be funny or it gives it away. Like I wasn't funny. That's why they hired me. but I noticed a lot of people I were working with were doing stand up. And then I started doing a show on VH1 that you all might not remember called Best Week Ever.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people got their start
on
Best
Week
Ever.
Totally, right? Yeah. Jesse Klein, Christian Finnegan, Nick Kroll, tons of people. So we'd go down to VH1 on Colorado and sit in a room four times smaller than this and just do jokes about pop culture.
Yeah.
And so that was helpful. And then a bunch of people just started suggesting that I do stand up, which I now realize was just their way of saying, please stop doing bits.
You need an outlet for this.
Yes. Yeah. Like, I'd be like telling some long story about how, like, I got a ticket, and they'd be like, you know, you should try stand up. Like, you should just go do this with strangers because we're not interested in your rambling. And then one night I did, it was at a place called M Bar that no longer exists on Vine and Fountain. Have you been there?
I've been here like 7 years.
Okay, so
I think that was before my LA time.
It was. It's Vine. It was a big stand-up.
But I've heard a lot about it.
Comics that have come in here?
That it's a, it was a big show.
Big deal. It was a huge, it was like UCB, right before I think UCB, maybe simultaneously, like the glory days of those shows. And I used to go and watch and watch and watch. And then MySpace was the thing. Oh. And I MySpaced a comic named Melinda Hill. And I asked her if I could be on her show. I'd never done stand-up before. And I think I lied to her. Sorry, Melinda. And was like, oh, yeah, can I just run some time? Like, I'd heard people say that. Like, can I come run a set?
Yeah.
and I told a story about like a bad date, and it actually went well, which is bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've done as well as the first time since. Still trying
yeah,
to
I feel
get...
like I hear that story a lot too. People are
Do
like, the
you?
First time was great, and then the next
and then horrible
50
for 5 years.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, that I didn't realize yeah. that was so such a common experience because you don't. You're not.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. You don't know what you're getting yourself into. Maybe.
And you, I think. If you go on and you do well the first time, you then start replicating what you did.
Yeah.
When in reality, you should be replicating the openness and the wonder and the spontaneity and being in the moment.
Yeah.
But you're trying to replicate your performance, and then it comes off robotic and probably rehearsed and rote. So, yeah. So then I bombed for like 3 years. And but, you know, the first couple of years, as Bobby Lee told me this, he's like, the first couple of years, don't worry about your material. It's just about getting comfortable on stage.
Yeah.
Which is just so true.
So eventually this leads up to a very big year for you, which was 2011, when you had two shows, Two Broke Girls and Whitney, get picked up at right around the same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how did you handle that success? That's a pretty rare experience, I would imagine, to have two shows right at the same time, and a lot of work.
Yeah, I don't know. It's so weird that people think that was a big deal. I mean, I understand. For me, it was the biggest deal on planet. All of a sudden, you know, I had $7 in my bank account, and then I could pay my bills. I mean, that was like, I got a car, like, you know. So it was monumental. And, you know, I grew up watching sitcoms, and, you know, it was always my dream to have one. I got to work with my, at the time, Chris D'Elia was a good friend of mine. I mean, to be doing a show with your friends, it was surreal. But I think what I hadn't really shared publicly before is that I had a bunch of like tragedies in my personal life almost simultaneously.
Oh, wow.
We got picked up in May, and then we start the writer's room in June. In late June, I had a very close family member go into rehab, and my mom had a stroke, and my dad had a stroke like 6 months later, which in a weird kismic thing, it was, thank God it was at that time, because I could actually afford to pay the bills.
Yeah.
But it was also, I wasn't really able to think about the amount of pressure I was under, because I was so distracted by that. I was like, you know, shooting and working all day and then going to like rehab at night, you know, to visit, you know. So I thankfully missed a lot of the I'm going to try to be positive, energy that came at me. You know, I didn't even know about the billboards. Like, I was like, going from my house in near here in Studio City to 5 blocks away to the studio to home to, you know.
Yeah.
And then one day I got invited to some NBC event, and, you know, they're like, you should go to this. This is a good look. And I drove and I saw all these billboards, and I was like, oh, fuck. This is crazy. And then it was like a joke on SNL, and then it was like on South Park. And I, you know, I didn't read the reviews. I didn't Google myself. I didn't have time. I feel lucky that I didn't, because I probably, it would not have ended well for me. I'd probably be on like a weird, like, sober in the house reality show on True TV.
Yeah.
I don't know what is it, Celebrity Rehab or something.
Yeah,
I'd be on some
Big Brother
something. Yeah. I'd be in a bad place. I'd be a contestant on Love Island had I actually seen all these reviews. So thankfully it didn't really sink in until later. But you know, I mean, it's looking back, I mean, it's definitely a little embarrassing, because I mean, you when you run your first show, you have no clue what you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like I was 26.
And how did it work logistically? Because you had Two Broke Girls and Whitney kind of going on at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, how were you even able to do that?
Yeah, well, Michael Patrick King ran Two Broke Girls. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know him. He's made the comeback with Lisa Kudrow.
And Sex and the City.
Sex and the City. So he's as good a comedy showrunner as they come. So he was very much running that creatively. Mm-hmm. And I would chime in and pitch jokes whenever I could and read scripts, but you know, for the most part I was really just trying to keep my head above water on the NBC show, because it was their only multicam on NBC at the time. I mean, before there were not multicams happening. It was The Office, it was 30 Rock, I think, started the year before. Multicams were not in vogue at all. In fact, people thought they were corny. They thought that there was a laugh track. It was bullshit, you know. People, which is weird, because we grew up on multicams, whether it was Seinfeld and Friends and Mad About You and
those
Cheers.
Those are the biggest shows.
The biggest shows. And kids love multi with these Nickelodeon shows. They're Wizards of Waverly Place and Chuck in Montana. I'm making
I'll
them
take
up
your
now.
Word for it.
Yeah, Chicky and Boo. I don't know. And so the numbers show people love multicams, but something about, you know, critics and...
Yeah, well, they fell out of favor a little bit, right? I mean, critically.
Did they? Critically.
Yeah.
they're the biggest.
Still very popular.
The most watched. I mean, even on Netflix, The Ranch and mm-hmm. Friends and Fuller House, I mean, are some of their biggest shows, you know. So so I think there's a little bit of a disconnect between what the public wants to watch and what critics want to watch. We all know that, and that's fine. But so, yeah, I think we got pretty killed on that. Critically, I think a lot of people thought it was a laugh track. I was getting a lot of, why is there a laugh track? Which was just so weird.
Yeah, which by what they mean laughs. I mean...
Yeah,
and I mean, because you perform in front of an audience, and
well, there's this, and I kept saying to the critics, I was like, just come to a taping, like you'll see the human beings in the audience. But you know, multicam is an inherently, you know, very tricky way to do comedy because the people that are there are so excited that they're gonna be like, ah, they're seeing their favorite comedian, they're seeing, you know, the celebrity that they love. They see Deb Messing right there, and anything she says, they're like, oh, they came from Orlando to see Deb Messing. So the audience at home is never going to be laughing as hard as it. So it's always going to feel like the laughs in the show are louder than what they deserve.
Yeah.
So it took me a while to figure out to just take the mics out of the audience and just make it less like a refrain.
Why are we having sex?
Because your hair's up and I ate pork.
When's the last time I wore my hair down?
2 years ago.
Okay. Be serious. I don't think we're having sex enough. I mean, why aren't we tapping this every night? Stay in that bed, all right? Because a storm of sexy is gonna come your way.
You know, because it's interesting because there were shows that were on that at that time that actually did have a real laugh track that would record laughs and put them in, and they would shoot during the days without a studio audience, just a block shoot.
Yeah, and then laughs in after.
And we were actually freaking Friday night at 6 o'clock. We're shooting in front of, you know, tourists, and we got killed for that. But I get, look, if I saw a poster that just said, you know, like Tiffany with a girl being like, I'm making a really corny smiley face for those of you that don't see me, I'd be like, oh God, what is that? You know, because I think just at the time, but I think multicams have started to sort of, people are a little more, I don't know, embracing them. I mean, the whole Roseanne thing went great.
Well, yeah, that did very well.
Coming up, Whitney opens up about how she felt when the Roseanne reboot completely imploded.
How did you end up becoming the showrunner for the Roseanne reboot?
I just am a fan of her tweets, you know?
just love those tweets.
I just think she makes some good points. that's going to be quoted out of context. I could see it now.
That was a joke. That
yes,
was a joke.
We'll see. Yeah. There's no such thing. No, I mean, I did it with Bruce Helford, who did the original, who's wonderful. And, you know, Tom Werner, who did, you know, the show, was a big producer on it. The producer on it, what am I saying? In the beginning is awesome. And him and I had worked together on something else. And anytime we'd work together, we shot an HBO pilot together, I would ask about Roseanne stories. You know, Roseanne, like... in writers' rooms is like there's legendary stories about the room and writers in the room and how it was shot, and there's just all this lore and truth about what went on, and I was just fascinated by it. I grew up watching Roseanne. I loved it. I grew up poor, and that was the first show that looked like my house. It was the first show that didn't make me feel bad about myself. It was the first show that was like, wait, my couch looks like that. Wait, my wallpaper looks like that. Wait, my mom complains about bills. Like, it, you know, I was watching 90210 and Melrose Place and all these shows where it's like, I'll never look like that. I'll never be like that. I'll never have a house like that. And, you know, I don't have to convince you guys why, you know, Roseanne, the show, was good. But what happened with the election, it was sort of like, okay, what now, what creatively, and I don't know,
because that's when it was after the election that the idea came up to do this,
because I think what happened was there's this huge disconnect between, you know, Hollywood writers and America. And I think there's this idea among some Hollywood writers that like America's stupid, and you know, I think the deplorables comment really was, you know, and I think what I loved about Roseanne, it was always just because we're poor doesn't mean we're stupid. And I have family members who are poor and that live in red states, and, you know, and I think a lot of people weren't feeling seen or heard. I'm not saying why people voted the way that they did, but they did, and they weren't being represented on television. And, you know, the opportunity to get content with a message into red states was very appealing to all of us, because a lot of the stuff we make only our echo chamber sees. We're so delusional about who watches what we make. And a lot of times we're in our echo chamber and we sort of forget there's a ton of people who are not watching what we make, and we're preaching to the choir. And I think just all of us, you know, Norm Macdonald was on the show, and Wanda Sykes was on the show, and Morgan Murphy was on the show.
Incredible writer's room.
Brilliant. And so it wasn't like a bunch of, like, there's this idea that it was like a bunch of right-wing racists writing the show. Yeah. I mean, it was really not at all. And we got very excited about the idea of putting something in the living rooms of states that we know, or demographics we normally would not be able to connect to, mirroring what was going on in the country in terms of what would happen when family members voted differently.
Yeah, I did see a quote from, you know, kind of, I think right before it premiered, where you were saying that you felt like you had to be the PC police sometimes in the writer's room. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's you know, and that's like makes me hate myself to hear that. It was more like, you know, we just really had to be careful in terms of depicting how this family and these characters would actually talk and actually behave. And if we were going to be offensive, it was for the right reasons and on purpose. So a big argument that was in the writer's room was the word illegals, right? The illegal, and Dan, construction worker, now freelance. The reality is that undocumented workers would be taking some of his jobs, or that's what's going on in his...
But he probably wouldn't call them undocumented.
Correct. He would say, in the privacy of his kitchen with his wife, 60-something years old, he probably would not say undocumented workers. Mm-hmm. But illegals is not the PC term. So there were just a lot of conversations.
Yeah, it's a tough
it's a tough one. There was, and, you know, people got angry on the crew. And so for me, I was definitely defending what would actually happen and how this character would actually talk, especially as someone who grew up being in love with John Goodman's character, Dan. And we wanted to be truthful, but also just making sure just we got it right, you know? And we definitely had a couple days where we were fighting about undocumented workers versus illegals. You know, what word would they use? Are they being offensive? Or are they just talking the way they would talk and trying to get that right?
So what, I mean, had you met Roseanne before you started doing this?
And by the way, we also had a, you know, Ames, the character in the show who wears a skirt, a boy, you know, and there was a lot of, is it gender nonconforming? Is it gender creative? Is it, you know, this transgender? What is it?
What and, term do you use?
Yes. And let's just get it right so we know how the characters get it wrong. We have to know what's right in order for them to screw up.
If they're
going to screw up. We have to understand this fully so they can misunderstand it. You know, so that's a lot of what that conversation was. Had I met Roseanne before? I had. I was a very big fan of hers. So the whole thing has been heartbreaking, to say the least, and surreal. Like, I forget that when people ask me about it, I'm like, huh? Like,
That happened.
I blocked it out. It's just traumatizing. But yeah, I was a fan of the show growing up. Huge fan, especially because, and I think the kind of work I like to watch and make is, one second you're laughing and one second you're crying. And that's always, you know, that show talked about domestic violence. It talked about race in a, at the time, really sophisticated way. Remember DJ wouldn't kiss the black girl in the school play? I mean, I remember watching that episode and it just blew my mind. And then the kid's father comes into the diner and Roseanne locks the door. I mean, it was just like wild. We had met a couple times doing stand-up. I went and saw her do stand-up, actually, when I was at the Jeff Garlin and Michael Moore do a film festival in Michigan. I don't whatever. So I'd gone and seen her, and she was hysterical. And it, yeah, it made a lot of sense at the time.
Yeah.
Like, so, every weird decision.
I mean, so you stepped down as showrunner before everything happened with the tweet about Valerie Jarrett and the blow up about that.
So
I think a lot of people out there probably think that you stepped down because of that, because it was kind of right before.
It was clear to me that
but so I mean, so why did you decide that it was something that you didn't want to do anymore?
It became, I wanted her to get off Twitter.
You saw a problem.
And I felt like it was going to come to a head. It was like whack-a-mole. It was just, you know. And I also, I'm going to be honest, and maybe people won't believe me, but I had not seen, I think there were tweets from years ago that weren't great.
Right.
You know, I hadn't seen those. I, you know,
But once it started getting press attention,
it started becoming, you know, there was the Trump phone call and, there, you know, it was just like kind of, oof, this isn't, I just thought we were all signing up to hold a mirror up to what was going on and hopefully do a funny, healing and nostalgic. I mean, there's something sort of healing about, like, let's all watch the show we all watched when we were kids. And, you know, I think if it was a new show about a low income family with like actors that we all know are rich, it would have been like a bullshit show. And you know, I think it had the potential to be really healing and to be able to start interesting conversations. And I, you know, the thing I did leave out was that before Michelle Obama left the White House, she did a conference call with showrunners. And I have no idea to this day who was on that call, but I did dress up in a blazer for a phone call. I had my little green blazer on and I was like, had my phone out and with this whole thing. And she basically explained these metrics on how they can now connect the passage of marriage equality to Will and Grace, how people in, you know, rural areas that maybe don't know gay people or the gay people they do know are in the closet or whatever, how what you see on television can translate to your value system and can move the needle in terms of progress. And that really resonated for me because I think that the story with writers and writers' rooms, and we're all like, we're not curing cancer, it's just a fucking joke, who gives a shit, you know, we kind of were like, whatever. And so that made me think like, oh cool, this can maybe be a powerful thing, especially a show that so many people are going to watch. Maybe this can bring us together, which sounds so naive now that I'm saying it.
Well, if it had just been the show and there hadn't been the Twitter, you know, all her tweets and her public presence, maybe that would have been true.
Maybe. You think?
Well, I don't. Well, I guess it's hard to know. Once everything did happen, I know you were kind of maybe hesitant to talk about it at the time.
I was dead quiet. My publicist, I kept trying to
tweet
about
it. You got on TMZ. I know that. That was
a nightmare. They got me in an airport. Yeah. I know. Because it was just not about me. And I think it's, you know, we all got to know when to just shut up. And I think for me, it was just that would have just created a bigger mess and involved me in something that was not mine to be involved in. You know, I just feel like everyone feels like they need to weigh it now. Like, you notice when someone dies, everyone has to like put a photo of them with the dead person. Yep. He was such a nice guy. She was the best.
Just to prove that they knew, but that you knew them.
Are you just posting this? Because this is a great photo of you.
Yeah.
Like, or just to get the likes or whatever. So I just had to really restrain myself and just remember, like, nobody's thinking about me. Nobody cares about me. No one's like, well, Whitney was involved. They're not interested in me at all. So I think I tried to just not weigh in, not as a strategy really, but just not, you know.
Is there anything that you want to say about it now? I mean, do you think that it was the right decision to say we're not going to work with her anymore for ABC?
Yeah, I think it was. It's just it's a shame. And the Connors is, you know, still on, and Sarah Gilbert is brilliant, and John Goodman and Laurie Metcalf. I mean, I'm in. I'll watch that show. I don't really. I'm still too shocked and confused to even know what to even think, because I'm still in this like, I should have done something. It's like, no, I shouldn't have. What could I try to, you know, what could I have done? It's just wildly unfortunate and disappointing and heartbreaking. But maybe, and maybe this is my 12-step program, like third step, everything happens for a reason thing. But, you know, maybe what needed to happen in the grand scheme of things is the head of that network made a very public statement of what will not be tolerated, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe that's the message that needed to be transmitted to everyone, because that story was massive.
It was. It was all anyone was talking about.
It was all anyone was talking about.
That's why they were looking for you in the airport.
I know. That was a nightmare. And I was just like, oh, fucking get out of here. I probably don't come off in that TMZ clip very
Does anyone come off well in
TMZ
clips?
Oh, I'm the worst. But I'm trying to remember what I said in that clip, and I can't remember. But maybe that's what needed to happen.
You said you were pissed off. That was one. I think that was the headline.
Yeah, probably. I was pissed. We all worked really, really hard on that. I mean, worked really hard on that. And a lot of us, you know, create. I won't speak for everyone because I'll get in trouble if I do. But, you know, it's just a shame. The episodes are just gone forever. You put your heart and soul into something for 12 months and it's just for nothing. Poop.
You got to work with Wanda Sykes and Norm Macdonald and all these people. I mean,
and wasn't, look, it's very hard to make a good multicam. This podcast has turned into how to make a good multicam episode. It's really hard, but Roseanne did it very well. Cheers did it very well. Friends obviously did it very well. But the way Roseanne, it's very hard to make a set look authentic and like a real place. It has to do with the paint. It has to do with the texture. It has to do with the set designer. It has to do with the lighting. It has to do with the colors. Everything is so important. And I wanted to learn the acting also. I mean, the actors on that show really do it like a play. I mean, you also John Goodman and Laurie Metcalf, so I don't know how there could possibly be bad acting, but to watch what the choices that they make and how the set was done, I really learned a lot about how to make a good multicam, so maybe I can use that moving forward and eventually make a good one.
So I do want to ask you about this project that I saw you have that you're, I don't know what stage it's at, Good People. Is that happening?
Or I hate talking about pilots on podcasts, because if it doesn't go, everyone's going to be like, hey, when do I get to see that? And in an airport, I have to be like, it didn't go.
Well, it's an insane cast and group of people that you're working with on that, too. Lee Daniels is involved, I know. And then I saw Lisa Kudrow, Martin Short.
Yeah, crazy.
So you made the pilot?
Greg Kinnear, we just shot the pilot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And look, Lee Daniels, I've been a fan of his for so long. And what we're talking about is basically whenever I was doing college tours, there's always something now before college. And I'm not complaining that we can't or being silenced or whatever, but I'm not that person. But it really is getting, you go to a college now and they're like, can you not talk about sports? Can you not talk about drinking? Can you not talk about sex? Can you not talk about race? They're just like, please, we don't want to get sued. And, you know, they just don't want any incendiary jokes, whatever. And I would always talk to the students and be like, what's going on campus? Because they'd tell you before you went on to make sure you didn't make a joke about it. So I'm hearing like, oh, this trans boy wants to play football and they won't let him. And the hormones are registering as testosterone. So even if a trans boy does make the team, doesn't get to play because all this crazy stuff. And a white girl had dreadlocks and there was a big fight about it. And then there's, all this stuff. And I'm like, who is the poor bastard who has to deal with all this shit? And then I found out it was something called the Ombudsman's Office. And they're like HR, but they deal with student complaints about inappropriate behavior. They feel they've been offended. Someone's wearing a MAGA shirt, someone wearing an Obama shirt, the cafeteria workers wearing a sombrero on Cinco de Mayo. That's appropriation. Like there's someone who has to deal with that stuff. And a lot of the things I don't even know what's right and wrong, and when do you let the inmates run the asylum and when do you step in? When are students just, sorry, you have to be uncomfortable. Sorry, that's the deal. We can't protect you from
it. So this is sort of the premise of the show.
Yeah. So Lisa Kudrow is the ombudsman, and she has to deal with all these student complaints. And, the mascot is, Native American stereotypical mascot and trying to get rid of them. It's just about all this stuff that we're...
Yeah. Well, I hope it gets picked up because it sounds fascinating.
Me too. Thank you. I hope so. Yeah. No pun intended.
So before we wrap up, what I like to do at the end is kind of just go through a few things we didn't get to talk about.
Oh, God. And did I ramble? Am I rambling?
No, you're great.
Are you sure?
Yeah. And talk about just the sort of first memory or story that comes to mind when I mention the project. So you talked a little bit about Punk'd, but I'm curious, does anything stick out in your memory from that was one of your earliest gigs on TV, I think?
I remember there was one comes to mind right away is Evan Rachel Wood, who at the time I think was 15.
And you guys Punk'd her?
Yes. And we had her come to like a fake museum. And I had to get her to accidentally back into a really expensive old piece of pottery. And she had to, and then it was rigged to break. And then she had to, and it just was not, it just was not working. And so, I just remember like yelling at Evan Rachel Wood when she was 15. Because I think I was playing like a gallerist or something. And I'm trying to take a picture of her. And I'm like, can you back up? And she's like,
no, I don't want to knock over
I'm not going to knock over your pot that you just told me was $8 million. There was a crazy one with Chris Klein. I remember we had to keep escalating. And this one was like a hostage. This was the worst. It was a hostage crisis at Chris Klein's house. And I do specifically remember being so bored waiting for him to come home. I was just sitting in the house and I was like going through like Katie Holmes's like wedding journal. I was just totally like, this is so crazy. I was like 22 years old in a celebrity's house, like going through their drawers. And I remember it was a hostage crisis. Chris Klein came home to a hostage crisis at his house and I was the hostage. And I remember running out. And my mic pack, we did a very good job of it. There were helicopters, like there were SWAT teams, like they really sold it. And bless his heart, I ran to a car and my mic pack fell out.
And you're not supposed to have a mic pack.
No,
you're a hostage.
Of course he's gonna go, fuck, this is fake. This is a reality or prank show, hidden camera prank show. And I'm like, fuck, I just fucked up the whole thing. And I looked down at it and he went, it's a bomb.
No way.
She's got a bomb attached to her. And then I was like, ah, the bomb. And I was like, it was just like, I remember that moment being so crazy that he actually was so, it was sold so hard.
He believed it so much that it was a bomb.
Yeah. It was pretty great. That's and really then I picked funny. It up and put it in my pocket. He was like, wait, what are you doing? I was like, I think the bomb's been deactivated.
What do you remember about your first late night stand-up performance? I believe it was on Conan's Tonight Show in 2010, but you can correct me if I have
I
that
definitely
wrong.
Did Last Call with Carson Daly. Oh, that, yeah. How dare you not go onto the deep web for that?
We're going to count that, I guess.
Please. Do not Google that. I remember that, please.
So that was the first one?
Yeah, that was, I think, the first one that I became a writer. That was my first job. Oh. I was a writer on Last Call with Carson Daly. And then I did, I think it did I do Conan? I don't know if I did Conan. I definitely did Leno.
Mm-hmm.
I sound like Valerie Cherish when I say that. My Leno.
Yeah.
I definitely did a Leno. I remember I teased my hair because for some reason I was like, I don't know. I thought I should have funny hair.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm a comic. And the hardest part about that I remember is you don't hold a microphone on the Tonight Show.
Mm.
So... You know, it's, always have a, and then they were like, oh no, you just have a lav mic. And then all of a sudden I was like doing
that's
jazz.
Bizarre,
jazz. I didn't know where to put my hands. I remember just like,
they don't let you hold a mic if you want to hold a mic.
You could, but I didn't know to ask.
Yeah.
They were just came out and mic'd mm-hmm. me. And I didn't know I could ask for what I needed or take control of my environment. I was just so like scared and nervous about being there. But Jay Leno was really nice to me. And I always appreciated that he had me on so much, but I always wanted to dress casual. So I would get a shirt, casual shirt, because I'm relatable. That was my whole mm-hmm. thing, just be relatable, wear a normal t-shirt, but you're on the Tonight Show, so I would sew little sequins and beads.
A little bedazzle situation.
So, yeah, so if you look at any of my early talk show appearances, I'm wearing t-shirts with sequins on them. I'm not
great.
Proud of that.
The first roast that you did was Joan Rivers.
Uh-huh.
So what do you remember about that night, and what did Joan Rivers mean to you at that time?
Oh gosh, she's a legend. You know, I mean, I think for me, when I first saw Joan Rivers, I knew her as the fashion correspondent.
Mm,
you know,
yeah.
And then it wasn't until I became a comedian that I found out like what she meant to mm-hmm. comedy. And I remember a couple things. Doing the roast at that time was very weird because you're basically insulting your hero. You're meeting your mm-hmm. hero for the first time and just insulting their face. I mean, it's just like crazy.
And you're pretty unknown at that time.
Nobody knew. I mean, I was a nobody. You know, most comics didn't even make jokes about. I mean, Greg Giraldo was just like, Whitney Cummings is here for some reason. Anyway, I mean, that was like
moving on.
That was
yeah.
the most I got, and then it was just your horror and whatever. Because what else would you say? And then. And I remember I got up there and I was so worried she was going to get mad at me, you know, because I had a lot of jokes about her face. And I got up. I think my opening joke for her was, Joan, I loved you in The Wrestler. It's fucking brutal. And then everyone was like, and they looked over at her and she just like really stone faced. And I was like, oh, fuck. Oh, God. I just pissed off Joan Rivers on television. This is bad. And then because she said, she's like, I'm laughing. It's the Botox. I'm laughing. So she subtitled her face for us so that she gave everyone permission. And, you know, her laugh just looked like a scowl at the time. And I remember. And then she was a really good sport about it. I remember the closing joke, I think, was Joan Rivers is so old. Her vagina has a separate entrance for black cocks. And just brutal. And she was so cool about it. A lot of those jokes actually ended up getting cut. But, you know. It's just weird to just hand. And then she got on and just destroyed me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And then, of course, there was the Trump roast 2 years later in 2011.
That happened.
Which is kind of a legendary night at this point.
Do people care?
Well, I think it gets a lot of attention and talked about because it was this, you know, it was this example of him trying to laugh at himself, which is not something he does anymore.
That's interesting. I mean, what was wild about it is that I got no concept that he was being insulted at all. Like, I think it was, and I remember people kept going, well, he's trying to run for president. We should write jokes about that. And I was like, that's not going to happen. Why are we writing jokes about this esoteric, like, weird joke he made?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I didn't even make jokes about it because I was like, this isn't relevant.
There's no chance that's going to happen.
There's no chance it's going to happen. It's too crazy.
Donald, you are gross. Nobody likes you, but you come back every couple years and nobody knows why. You're like the McRib.
Melania a huge 12-carat diamond engagement ring. You should not have gotten her a diamond. Now she knows what hard is supposed to feel like. Said that you wanted to run for president. That is such a publicity stunt. If I wanted to support a greedy whore who's pretending to run for president just to get on TV, I'd vote for Sarah Palin.
And then I remember him just being really just psyched to be the center of attention. Mm-hmm. I remember being like, this guy's...
Can imagine that.
It was at the time a dream person to roast, because as long as you were talking about him, he was in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, who was it? Jerry Springer and Larry... King.
Larry King, yeah. Seth MacFarlane.
And it was in New York, I remember, and the room was, it was all his friends. Normally, when you shoot the roast in LA, it's comedy people, mm-hmm. it's, you know, friends of
he
ours.
He packed the audience.
He packed it with his friends, and it was just like, fuck, so weird. Surreal. A lot of people, you know, a lot of comics think that we're kind of to blame in a lot of ways for this, because when you make fun of someone, it sort of helps him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I guess we'll never know
whether, we'll never
what,
know.
What that impact was.
Yeah.
So the last thing that we do on the show is I ask everyone what the last thing that made you laugh really hard is. It could be a TV show, it could be a movie, a stand-up performance, or just anything that comes to mind.
This is hard for me to do because I see comedy all the time.
Are you a big laugher, or do you feel like, does it take a lot to make you laugh?
It depends. Like, it's weird because when you see so much comedy, like I was watching Sebastian's special and I'm just like, fuck, that's funny. Fuck. Like, you get jealous.
Sebastian Maniscalco.
Yeah, Maniscalco. Yeah, you get a little bit more like, God damn it. You know, you get angry when you,
you get
hear.
Get a little jealous.
Yes,
or,
you're just like, ah, shit. Fuck, that's a good joke. Like, you just get annoyed when you hear comics. And I'm the worst. People say I'm the worst to audition for, because when they say something funny, I just go, ha! Like, you just like make a sound.
Yeah.
Because sort of genuine laughter is harder and harder to get, because comedy becomes kind of like a business. But I definitely actually laughed at the memory of something recently so mm-hmm. hard, and it's probably not going to translate at all. Brody Stevens, I was telling someone a story about him since he passed, and someone was like, well, what was his comedy, you know? And he made me laugh in a way that it was just so surprising and so abstract, and, you know, he always cracked me up. And I was watching some of his YouTube videos and posting them, and I was laughing. But he, one time we were at the Comedy Store, he was ringing in New Year's Eve, and if you guys know anything about Brody Stevens, he's like the worst person to be like, 10, 9, you know, and because if you wouldn't laugh at him, he would just go in on you, don't get me, you know, he would just go in on you. Okay, here's why you should have laughed. Like, it's just the audience sometimes doesn't understand what's going on if they're not comedy savvy. And I remember they weren't laughing at him because everyone bombs on New Year's in the main room of the Comedy Store at this time.
Mm-hmm.
It's all like tourists and, like, you know, Austrian couples that had a Groupon back in the, now it's popping there, but it wasn't at the time. And he came out and he was doing the countdown, and he just goes, you know what? I will ruin your New Year's. And it was just so, the idea that these people came to the show and this comic is just yelling at them, saying, I'm going to ruin your New Year's. That's the kind of sinister thing that makes a numb, dead inside comedian laugh.
I love that story. Thank you. And thank you for doing the podcast. This
thank
was really
you for
fun.
Having me. I hope this was good. See you in the comments, guys. Can't wait for your notes.
Yeah, let us know what you think.
Let me know if you like me. Can't wait for you to tell me I'm old.
All right. Thanks so much. Thank you again so much to Whitney Cummings. Like she said, let us know what you thought about this episode and others on the Apple Podcasts app. And check out her new special, Can I Touch It? It's streaming right now on Netflix. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.